The Book of Esther was possibly written by Mordecai, Ezra, or Nehemiah, sometime between 460 and 350 BC. It follows a Jewish community living in Persia 100 years post-exile. The story begins with the king of Persia getting rid of his wife and setting up a beauty pageant to find a new queen. A Jewish woman named Esther wins the contest but conceals her Jewish identity. During this time, the king elevates an official named Haman to second in command. Haman abuses his newly received power and orders that everyone must also bow down to him. Esther's uncle Mordecai refuses, leading to Haman issuing a decree that all Jewish people be wiped out. In the middle of a sleepless night, the king has the chronicles of the kingdom read to him. He recalls a moment when Esther's uncle Mordecai saved his life from a murderous plot and plans to publicly honor this Jewish man. As the decree to murder the Jews nears, Esther approaches the king and courageously reveals her true Jewish identity, along with Haman's wicked plot to wipe out her people. The king shows favor to Esther, ordering Haman's execution, and provides a means to save the Jewish people. While God's name is never mentioned, his providential care is evident through every act of the story. God elevates the humble characters of Esther and Mordecai at the right time to preserve his people from human wickedness.
How's it going, Riv? We are one quarter of the way through a 66-week series. And so if you're just joining us, you're here at a good time. We are in week 17 of a 66-week series where we're preaching one message out of every book of the Bible from beginning to end, so from Genesis to Revelation. And this week marks the end of the books of history, and next week we're going to move into the wisdom literature. And what that means is this week we are in the book of Esther, and pretty much the video you just watched is the entire story. Like, the book of Esther is, in my Bible at least, only 7 pages long. It's a really short book, but it's also an incredibly difficult book to preach a sermon out of. And the reason is God doesn't get a shout out in the entire book. He's not mentioned by name at all. In fact, there's almost no spiritual life that is shown in this book, with the exception of a few people at one time fasting. And that's about it. So you could easily read this whole book and miss a beautiful picture of the gospel that is there. Because it's easy, depending on your background, to read this book very differently. For some of us, we're going to open this book and we're going to read it and we'll go, that is like totally a Disney princess story. And it sort of is. And some of us are going to read that book and say, man, that is like a political thriller that could be ripped out of the headlines today. And it kind of is. And some of us could read it and say, man, that's a book all about the haves and the have-nots in our culture. And it kind of is. But just like every other book in the Bible, there is a gospel theme that runs through the book of Esther. And so let's go through this book, starting in the verse chapter, the first verse. Esther 1:1 says this: these events took place during the days of... And I'm going to stop there because that word has killed me all week. This is a dude's name, okay? This is the king, and I'm going to have to say this a lot. And so my daughter, who puts together the children's curriculum, was working this week, and she texted me, and she says, how the heck do you say this guy's name? And I'm like, I don't know. So the two of us began researching it, and we came up with all of these different ways to pronounce his name. One is Ahasuerus, like he's swearing at you. One is Ahasuerus, one is Ahasuerus, like I has a wrist, right? That's how my daughter was leaning toward that. That's an easy one for her. My favorite was Ahasuerus, like he's a dinosaur. And then I said to my daughter, I said, oh, it's like Ahasuerus Rex. And Rex means king. So as soon as we got there, I'm like completely flummoxed. And I'm like, I'm never going to be able to say this guy's name. So then I look in other translations, and in the NIV translation, they translate this word Xerxes. So that's what I'm using. So just so you know, every time we hit this guy's name, I'm saying Xerxes or the king, because there's no way I'm going to get it. I couldn't do it. So anyway, that's my true confession to start today. These events took place during the days of Xerxes, who ruled 127 provinces from India to Kush. Now here's how big that was. The 127 provinces that made up the Persian Empire went all the way from Iran to southern Ukraine, all the way from Egypt, all the way over to portions of India. So this was massive, the Persian Empire at this point. And in those days, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the fortress of Susa. He held a feast in the third year of his reign for all of his officials and staff, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and the officials from the provinces, and he displayed the glorious wealth of his kingdom and the magnificent splendor of his greatness for a total of 180 days. Get this. In the third year of this guy's reign, which is not a long time, he decides to throw himself a party so everyone knows how great he is, to show the majesty of his own splendor and his greatness, and he throws a six-month-long party in his own name. You beginning to get an idea of who this guy, what this guy's like? And what does he do at the end of his party? At the end of this time, the king held a week-long banquet. So he gets done with his six-month party, and he throws a one-week party in the garden courtyard of the royal palace for all the people from greatest to least. So the first party was for the VIPs, for the governors, for the military, for the pop singers, you know, for everybody like that in the entire Persian Empire. And now he's celebrating with just the people who live in the fortress, but it's everybody from the greatest to the least. White and violet linens hangings were fastened with fine white and purple linen cords to silver rods on marble columns. Gold and silver couches, which were probably not comfortable, were arranged on a mosaic pavement of red feldspar, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. I want you not to miss this important point. He paved his courtyard with jewelry. And that was just decoration for the party. So he throws this six-month party, then he throws this seventh-month party, decorating his courtyard with all this jewelry, and the drinks were served in an array of gold goblets, each with a different design. So he designs everybody their own custom cup, each with a different design. Royal wine flowed freely according to the king's bounty. The drinking was according to this royal decree. There are no restrictions. Like literally, he passed a law that said, during my party, there are no restrictions. Just drink up whatever you want. The king ordered every wine steward in his household to serve whatever each person wanted, and Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women of King Xerxes' palace. And so are you beginning to get a picture of what this guy is like? He is ostentatious. He flaunts his wealth. He's gaudy in his designs. He wants everyone to be overwhelmed with his greatness. And throughout this story, what we see is he is absolutely all surface and show. He has other people making up his mind for him. He is super sensitive. He flies off the handle easily, and he is all about appearances. This is this dude. Verse 10. And on the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, Xerxes commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass the seven eunuchs who personally served him to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown. He wanted to show off her beauty to the people and the officials because she was so very beautiful. So do you get what's happening here? This guy has just got done showing off everything in his kingdom, all of his extravagant wealth, the fact that he could pave his courtyard with jewelry, the fact that he could have custom gold mugs made for everybody that shows up at his party. He's got wine flowing and he says, listen, drink as much as you want. He's throwing this massive party, showing off everything that he has, and now he wants to show off his prized possession, his wife. And what do you think he wants her to show off? Her calculus skills? She's a trophy wife. He wants to show off her beauty. That's all he wants to do. And the most remarkable thing happens. She says, no. She's like, I'm not coming. There's no way you are going to parade me around in front of your drunken buddies. So how do you think he responded to her response? Did he say, oh, honey, I'm so embarrassed. I'm sorry. I put you in an awkward position. I had too much to drink. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm so sorry. No way. This guy was furious. It said anger burned inside of his heart. And because of that anger, the king consulted the wise men who understood the times, for it was his normal procedure to confer with experts in law and justice. Now, don't miss the irony of this. The most powerful man in the world, who governs 127 provinces across the Persian Empire, can't control his wife, so he calls his trusted advisors to tell him what to do with his wife. Verse 14, the most trusted ones were Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Marys, Mersana, and Memucan, which I think is a transformer. These were the seven officials of Persia and Media who had personal access to the king and occupied the highest positions in the kingdom. And the king asked, according to law, what should be done with King Vashti since she refused to obey King Xerxes' command that was delivered by the eunuchs? In other words, he's now speaking of himself in the third person, saying to his advisors, the queen will not obey King Xerxes, so what can we legally do? Now, what is his concern? It's image. He's got everybody in the kingdom, everybody from the palace is there now. So everybody from greatest to least is there, and he is now looking weak, and he's feeling insecure, and he's like, how can I get this back? How can I look powerful again? And so Memucan said in the presence of the king and his officials, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but all the officials and all the peoples who are in every one of King Xerxes' provinces. This is a slight overstatement. For the queen's actions will become public knowledge to all the women and cause them to despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes ordered Queen Vashti brought before him, but she did not come. Before this day is over, the noble women of Persia and Media who hear about the queen's act will say the same thing to all the king's officials, resulting in contempt and fury. If it meets the king's approval, he should personally issue a royal decree. Let it be recorded in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be revoked. Vashti is not to enter King Xerxes' presence, and her royal position is to be given to another woman who is more worthy than she. The decree the king issues will be heard throughout his vast kingdom, so all women will honor their husbands from the greatest to the least. Sound like a little bit of an overstatement? And listen, the king, as we probably would guess, loved it. So what does he do? He has this order written into every language of the 127 provinces because he wants to make sure everybody gets it. Because obviously, word is, and this is pre-internet. Only the people at the party even knew about this, but he writes this thing, and he has it sent out to all the 127 provinces to let everybody know that his wife dissed him, and he has now kicked her out of the palace. Sometime later, when King Xerxes' rage had cooled down, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what he had decided against her, and the king's personal attendants suggested, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Now, here's the thing. That word attendant there is a word that is only shows up in the Bible in one place. It's here. And so it's a little bit goofy to try to interpret, but it is likely a word that means young dude. Right? And so these are not the trusted advisors that he goes to for public policy. It's a bunch of testosterone-laden young men. So what do you suppose they're going to come up with as a criteria for the new queen? Noble birth, intellect, sense of humor, poise. Let the king appoint commissioners in each province of the kingdom so they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in the fortress of Susa. We are going to hire people to go to all 127 provinces in this entire massive Persian empire, and we're going to find every beautiful virgin and bring them to town. Put them under the supervision of Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the women, and give them the required beauty treatments, and then the young woman who pleases the king will become queen instead of Vashti. This suggestion pleased the king. Of course it did. And he did accordingly. The measure of the new queen's worth is going to be purely on looks. But before you judge, remember that we have Tinder. This is just pre-internet Tinder. That's all it is. And into this beauty pageant of sorts enters a young woman by the name of Esther. She's a young Jewish woman. And I'm just going to read the description of her. It's not on the screen because I just want you to listen to it. It says this: the young woman had a beautiful figure and was extremely good looking. Beautiful body, beautiful face. It's exactly what the king is looking for. And so she makes it through the prelims and she makes it to the final rounds. Verse 12, during the year before each young woman's turn to go to King Xerxes, the harem regulation required her to receive beauty treatments with oil of myrrh for 6 months and then with perfumes and cosmetics for another 6 months. That is a one-year makeover. I've heard of people taking a long time to get ready for an event. This is crazy town. 1 year of getting ready for the king. And when the young woman would go to the king, she was given whatever she requested to take with her from the harem to the palace. She would go in the evening, and in the morning she would return to a second harem under the supervision of the king's eunuch Shashgaz, keeper of the concubines. She never went to the king again unless he desired her and summoned her by name. So you get what's going on here? So basically, each of these women, after a year of beauty treatments, was able to take anything that they wanted that they thought could coax the king into selecting them. They could just take anything that they wanted, and they would go to the king when? In the evening, and then they would leave in the morning. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see what's happening in between, right? The criteria by which he is going to choose his queen. And so this is, it's like The Bachelor. Now remember, this king is ostentatious. He just cares about outward appearances. He wants everyone to be overwhelmed by his greatness. And his ultimate trophy is his wife. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter. So Mordecai was kind of like her cousin uncle, who adopted her when her parents died when she was young. And when her turn came to go to the king, she did not ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the women, suggested. And Esther gained favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. And this word favor, it is much more than just her beauty. There was just something about Esther. She didn't need gimmicks. She didn't really need the whole beauty treatment, hashtag no makeup. It was just not only how she looked but and how beautiful she was, but it was who she was as a person. People were drawn to her, and so it's no surprise that the king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins, and he placed the royal crown on her head, made her queen in place of Vashti, and the king held a great banquet for all of his officials and staff, because that's all he knows how to do. He throws a party. It was Esther's banquet. He wanted everybody to know that he had a new queen, and he freed his provinces from tax payments. He gave everybody a tax cut. Why did he do that? So that every time they thought about their tax cut, they thought of the queen, so that they thought about him. So the whole thing is structured so that they are always thinking about him and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty. All right, let's just stop here for a second. There is nothing remarkable about this story. Nothing. And what you got is you got a pompous king, and history has had a lot of pompous kings, who manipulated a situation so that he could have the most beautiful wife, and that is not remarkable. There's been a lot of kings that have done that down through history. There's nothing remarkable here. In fact, the next thing that happens is not remarkable. There's a couple guys that decide they've had enough of this king and they're going to assassinate him, but their plot kind of gets out. And Mordecai, Esther's uncle, hears about it. And so he runs to Esther and tells Esther that there's some people plotting to kill Esther's husband. And then Esther tells her husband. Her husband investigates, finds out the guys are going to kill him, so he kills them. And again, not remarkable. That's happened down through history all the time. And the next thing that happened was not remarkable. The king found this guy named Haman, and he put him in charge because he was having so much fun with his wife. He thought, you run things for me. You can have complete control. And the guy's like, great, I love control. And so he told everybody, hey, whenever you see me, you got to bow down to me. Again, not remarkable from a historic perspective. But the next thing that happened was remarkable. Because as Haman would walk around the city and everybody would drop to their knees in front of him and bow down to him, one guy didn't. He would just stand there. A guy by the name of Mordecai, Esther's uncle. And as you can probably imagine, that did not go well. Chapter 3, verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying him an homage, he was filled with rage. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, the fact that he was Jewish, it seemed repugnant to Haman to do away with Mordecai alone. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout Xerxes' kingdom. And again, there is nothing remarkable about this, because again and again and again, down through history, people have tried to wipe out the Jews. It's an unremarkable thing because it happens so often from a historic perspective. And this guy's plan was simply this. He sent a directive to all 127 provinces that was sealed and had a date on it and said, I want everyone to open this at the same time. Synchronize your watches, open this at the exact same moment. And when everybody opened it up, it would say in there, the exact moment that he wanted every Jew killed. And so they would send out their people so that at the exact same moment on the same day, every Jew from old to young, every single one of them was wiped off the face of the planet. That was his plan. And yet somehow Mordecai finds out about this. It's pretty connected. He finds things out. And so he starts messaging back and forth with Esther. Not with his phone, different kind of messaging, sending a messenger back and forth. And this messenger would go back and forth and back and forth as they were trying to figure out this whole situation. And eventually, Mordecai messages her with this. Don't think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you are in the king's palace. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place. But you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Now, here's the thing about Esther, the book. God's not explicitly mentioned anywhere. But you see something here in Mordecai. I mean, maybe, just a guess, an educated guess, but maybe Mordecai would not bow down because he remembered the stories of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And the fact that when they were commanded by King Nebuchadnezzar to bow down, that they wouldn't do that. Maybe he has good theology, understanding that God always is ultimately in control. And there's no stroke of a pen. There's no drunken party that happens outside the sovereign will of God. And so he says to her, maybe, just maybe, God created you beautiful for this. Maybe, just maybe, God made you queen for this. See, so often we look at this crazy world around us and we think, what is going on? How can all of the chaos and crazy in this world fit within God's sovereign plan? I mean, how does this work? And my favorite illustration, and forgive me if you've heard this before because I've used it before, is a cross-stitch loom. And if you don't know what that is, Google it right now, look at an image of it. A cross-stitch loom is something that my grandma, so a lot of your great-grandmas, probably would do. And it's like this little thing where she would stitch with threads a little pattern. So maybe she'd make a little thing that says, home sweet home. Or there'd be like a little Bible verse on it or whatever, grandma's heart, and it had pictures of you or whatever. But so it's all pretty and stitched on this side. But if you flip the loom over to the other side, it's a mess. Because all the threads are hanging down on the other side because all you're worried about is the pattern on the top side. So the bottom is just kind of a tangled mess. Well, imagine, if you will, the entirety of human history has a giant loom over it. And from our side, the bottom, it's a mess. There's all these different color strings hanging down. And not only that, there's all these needles going up and down pulling strings. And there's some idiot over here grabbing one and drunk, and he's like, and he's stabbing people and he's throwing it back up and he doesn't care. And then there's other people who are trying to be very, very careful, and they're trying to see a pattern because you can kind of see a pattern sometimes from the bottom. Not really, but some, they're trying to be as careful as they can. And then sometimes you see the needles flying back down, and sometimes the needles that fly down hit somebody that you love. Sometimes they hit you. And you're like, what is going on? Well, the reality is, from our side, it's a mess. And it is only when we flip to the other side, on the other side of eternity, that we can see the picture that God is weaving together out of the mess of our lives. And so Mordecai says to Esther, maybe, perhaps, you have come to your royal position. All this good, all this that you have now, it is for this one moment, for such a time as this. So this is her response. Go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way, and after that I will go to the king, even if it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went and did everything Esther had commanded him. If I perish, I perish. You see how Esther's heart is even more beautiful than she is on the outside? And so this is how the whole thing went down. It's the next three chapters. Basically, she gets herself dolled up after the 3 days. She figures, hey, God made me beautiful. I'm going to leverage my beauty, right? That's what Mordecai just said. Maybe you were created beautiful with it. So she's like, okay, I'm going to leverage everything. So she gets herself all dolled up with all of her royal garments on, and she goes to the courtyard outside the king's throne room because she's not allowed to go in. If she goes in without him calling, she could die. And so she's standing on the outside the door, so he can kind of see her when the doors open. And eventually he sees her and he says, Esther, Come in. And she comes in and he goes, what do you want? I will literally give you half the kingdom if you want. I mean, he just loved her this much. And she says, you know what I'd like? I'd like to have dinner. You and me and Haman. The three of us, let's have dinner. I've actually been putting this banquet together. Why don't the three of us have dinner tonight? And he's like, great, let's have dinner. And so they get together and they have dinner. And the king is drinking wine. And he's like, honey, what do you want? I will give you half the kingdom. Just what do you want? And she said, you know what would be really nice? Let's have dinner tomorrow. Let's do this again. This has been great. You and me and Haman, let's have dinner tomorrow. And Haman leaves the room so happy, right? He's like practically skipping home. He's like he got to have dinner with the king and queen. He's going to have dinner again. And he's going down the streets and everybody is bowing down to him. And then he sees friggin' Mordecai just standing there, and he's like, I hate that freaking guy. And so he goes home and he says to his wife and his friends, he's like, I was having such a good day. It was the greatest day. I had dinner with the king and queen. I'm having dinner with them tomorrow. They invited me, just me, and then freaking Mordecai ruined my whole day. And his wife was like, well, I got a plan. Why don't you build a 75-foot-tall gallows in our yard? And then tomorrow morning, break of dawn, go see the king and say, hey, king, do you mind if I hang Mordecai? Because you see, the king loves you. He loves you, and he's having dinner with you. I mean, of course he's going to do that, and it'll be a great day. You hang Mordecai in the morning. You have dinner with the king and queen in the afternoon. It's a great day. He said, that's a good plan. So that night, the king is tossing and turning in bed. He can't sleep. So he calls his attendants, and he's like, guys, would you read me a story? Now, what kind of story do you suppose he wants? He's like, would you guys read me the story of me? So they read him the story of him, all that he has done in their kingdom. And it goes on all night. And just at the break of dawn, they get to this part of the story where he's like, where Mordecai overhears that there's a couple guys plotting to assassinate the king. And how Mordecai came and told Esther, and that Esther told the king, and the king investigated, and then those guys were caught. And the king's like, did we ever do anything for that guy? And the attendant's like, no, we didn't. He's like, we should do something for him. What should we do for him? And right then Haman arrives. And Haman's like, hey, king, I got a request. He goes, before you get to that, can I ask you something? Like, if I wanted to honor somebody awesome, and I wanted to just make sure everybody knew how great they were, what would you suggest I do? Now, who do you think Haman thinks he's talking about? Himself, right? So he goes, well, I've been thinking about this very thing. I think what you should do is you should give this person, whoever they may be, you should give this person one of your royal robes that you have worn, still has your smell on it, and you should give them your horse to ride, and then you should pick a noble person to lead the horse around town in a parade announcing how awesome that person is and how much the king loves them. And the king is like, I like it. Do that for Mordecai. And you can be the nobleman. Yes, you can lead him around on the horse and say how awesome he is. And so he does. Look how awesome. The king loves this guy. Ruins his day. So then he gets to dinner. And he sits down with king and queen and Haman. And the king says, so finally, will you just tell me what you want, Esther? What do you want? And she said, well, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I just want to live. I just don't want to perish. I want my life to be spared and for my people to be spared, and there is somebody that is out to destroy us. And the king says, who? Haman. Let's pick up the story in chapter 7, verse 7. The king arose in anger and went from where he was drinking wine to the palace garden. So he's so angry, he runs outside of the garden. And Haman remained to beg Queen Esther for his life because he realized the king was planning something terrible for him. And just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling onto the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, would he actually violate the queen while I'm in the house? As soon as the statement left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, you know, there's a gallows 75 feet tall at Haman's house that he made for Mordecai, who gave the report to save the king. And the king said, hang him on it. And they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Do you see the gospel thread? What is this story really about? This story is about God keeping his promises to his people. Remember, I mentioned that this was the last history book? Let's go back to the beginning. Book of Genesis. God chooses an unremarkable man by the name of Abraham. And he just says, I pick you. I just pick you because I pick you. And I'm going to give you land, descendants, and blessing unconditionally forever. And from you, from your line, the entire world will be blessed. It's a promise that God makes to his people. And what that means is there's no way Haman was going to wipe them out. It just wasn't going to happen. Because God is God, and when God makes a promise, he fulfills his promise. He loves his people. He cares for his people. There was no way the Jews were going to be wiped off the face of the planet. And it's easy to read this story and to think it's just like, I don't know, like an R-rated Disney princess movie, right? Or something ripped from the headlines, or something that's just about the haves and the haves not. It's easy to say that the moral of the story is be like Esther, be brave. That's not the moral story. It might be a moral of the story, but it's not the moral of the story. I mean, you might think that the moral story is, well, be like Mordecai. Don't bow down before all these other guys. That's a moral of the story. It's not the moral of the story. The moral of the story is ultimately that God is keeping his promises. The moral of the story is that God will ultimately keep his promises when through the Jewish people, the whole world is blessed through Jesus. And he was not going to let anything happen that was going to stop that from taking place. We live in a chaotic world. There's people grabbing those threads and taking those needles and stabbing people out of malice. There's drunken idiots just throwing them everywhere. There's arrogant politicians. There's people trying to do their best. And God is just weaving his story together. And his story is all about his glory and the fame of Jesus. Have you ever pondered your life and asked the question, perhaps I am where I am, positive or negative, for such a time as this? Is it possible that in this grand story that God is telling, I got a place right now? Because you are part of the story that he's telling. You're part of the picture he's painting. You're part of the cross stitch he's stitching. And a lot of it is going to be in just unremarkable ways, in unremarkable stories. But God does remarkable things through unremarkable people for the fame of Jesus and the glory of God the Father. And sometimes it's in positive moments, and sometimes it's in pain, but I don't want to spoil next week's sermon. So let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the story of Esther and Mordecai and Haman and Xerxes. And we thank you that you are the God that does remarkable things through unremarkable people so that the whole world will know about our remarkable God. Help us to be able to make it through the messy chaos of the world we are living in by longing for that day when we get to see the picture complete on the other side. Give us strength when we need it. Give us patience. And help us to always keep our eyes on the image on the other side, the image of Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.